Court is ready to hear argument. Petitioner in Union Pacific versus Williams.
May it please the Court. Mr. Wilson will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Anecdotally, I find myself in a unique position today in that not only is my first opportunity to speak to the Supreme Court of the state of Texas, but I'm here to argue an appeal in which I did not write the brief, as it was written by now Justice Anthony Hrasmacek, in a case that we were unsuccessful at intermediate appeal on a case that I did not try and, in fact, didn't work for the railroad at the time that the case was tried. Many would consider that to be an unenviable position to be in, because I think we have an opportunity, Union Pacific, as the appellant, has an opportunity to present a case to this court to substantially correct or revise a prior opinion, and we look forward to that opportunity. The case, again, my name is Fred Wilson, representing the Union Pacific Railroad Company in this matter, and as petitioner, in which Seymour Williams, a former employee of the Union Pacific Railroad, is the appellee, or the respondent. Essentially, this was a trial regarding an injury to a Union Pacific employee, a railroad employee, and therefore took place under the Federal Employer Liabilities Act, which is also more commonly known as the FELA or the FELA. I'll probably refer to it as the FELA just in the interest of time, because it's a long name for an act. The act is the sole law regarding how a railroad employee is entitled to sue to recover for damages for injuries he suffers during his employment.
In proffering the foreseeability instruction at trial, at the charge conference, was it ever brought to the court's attention that somehow the foreseeability instruction should be limited to the duty question as opposed to the causation question? Was that ever specifically set out? Because under Mitchell, it would be improper if it would confuse foreseeability in the causation analysis.
Correct, I agree with you.
And if that's the case, unless it's pointed out to the court that this issue is this instruction is segregable to the duty question, how could the trial court have possibly abused its discretion under clearly established Supreme Court authority?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the... I can't tell you specifically if that was discussed, but my position would be, in responding to your question, is that it wouldn't need to be discussed because the charge that was presented to the court was satisfactory. The charge was a question of whether or not it was foreseeable that if the railroad foresaw any harm in this situation, if it had constructive or actual knowledge of
it. Well, it was
harm.
The same, let's say for purposes of argument, it was the same instruction that was proffered in Mitchell.
Okay.
And the court in Mitchell said that it could cause confusion with the jury, because to the extent it could be construed to relate to causation, it would be improper. And so, to me, it would seem that unless it's focused to the piece of the jury charge that would be relevant to duty, that just generically giving that instruction would be error.
I respectfully disagree. I believe the charge that was presented to the court was tailored to the duty.
How? Because the instructions that I saw in the record were just 5 or 6 general instructions. They don't pertain to a particular question.
What was offered was the instruction that before you may find a railroad liable for an injury of an employee resulting from a defective condition, equipment, or his place of work, you must be satisfied that the railroad had either actual or constructive notice of the defective condition and that it had a reasonable opportunity to remove or repair the defect.
Yeah, same instruction as Mitchell.
Exactly, similar to in Mitchell.
And Mitchell said because it could be construed by the jury to relate to causation, it's confusing.
That is what Mitchell, the majority opinion in Mitchell said. And that's
how could a trial court abuse its discretion then in rejecting such an instruction? I mean, I can... Let's say we agree that foreseeability should be submitted to the jury as a duty element. And let's say we agree with that. How was it brought to the court's attention that instruction was intended to be limited to the duty element as opposed to possibly causing confusion as in Mitchell that it applied to causation?
My argument there would be that the way it's worded, and we say it's similar to the jury charge in Mitchell, is that it's on its face relates to the duty issue. It's not one of the questioning as to did Union Pacific foresee this particular injury, this result, that relates to the causation issue. It relates to did they foresee a harm? Was a harm in this? Was there a harm in this workplace that was reasonably should have been foreseen by this?
You're saying the language itself indicates that it related to the duty question.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Well, then what? Then we'd have to overrule Mitchell if that is the case in order to go your way.
To the extent that Mitchell says, to the extent that Mitchell has read the way that you're presenting it to me, yes. And that's another position, reason that I consider myself, some would consider it to not be in an enviable position and that I'm coming before a court and asking it to overrule itself.
But why can't this case be reconciled with Mitchell? Mitchell did deal with foreseeability in the context of causation in a FELA claim, which is different than foreseeability with respect to the duty issue.
I'm sorry.
Mitchell deals with foreseeability and causation. Do you think it's wrong with respect to that aspect?
Let me have to make sure I understand your question. Do I think that Mitchell is wrong in that precludes a jury instruction regarding foreseeability regarding causation?
Yes, because of the way causation is defined in FELA.
No, I do not think it's wrong.
Okay, so why would Mitchell have to be overruled then, since Mitchell didn't dealt with the question of submitting an instruction on foreseeability in connection with causation?
First off,
okay.
I didn't say it necessarily had to be overruled. I said if you read it in the way that Justice O'Neill has presented that question, if that's how you read that as the black letter law in Mitchell, then yes.
My understanding was that that's the way you defined it. You're saying the instruction itself, the way it's worded, indicates that it's necessary for negligence determination, and that was enough to alert the trial court. It was limited to the duty piece. And if that's the case, the court in Mitchell said, no, as far as it going to causation, it's improper. I was doing it the way you were defining it.
I'm sorry. Well, I mean, if you follow the court's analysis in Mitchell, or you follow the way it was applied in this particular case, the result is that there's no instruction given regarding foreseeability as to the duty, which means there's no instruction given to the jury in a case where I think the parties...
And that was my original question. Where did you ask the trial court to submit it on the duty element? Did you say, we realize if this were just given and could cause confusion that it relates to causation, it would be error under Mitchell. So, Judge, we really want it limited to the duty question. Was that ever done?
Candidly, I don't know.
I think along with that, did Union Pacific ask for a question to be submitted to the jury along with that instruction? Foreseeability in the duty aspect.
What Union Pacific asked for is the proposed jury instruction.
Question.
No, Your Honor.
Well, if I understood your briefing, it's your view that the foreseeability issue is a disputed fact question.
That is correct.
And that, therefore, the jury should have had the opportunity to make that decision.
That is correct.
How can they make that decision if you don't submit a fact question for them to answer and just give them a naked instruction like you proposed here?
Well, if we give the naked instruction, as you define it, that the Union Pacific is responsible for its negligence, if there's a harm that it should have reasonably foreseen, the jury therefore takes that into account in its deliberations here.
Well, but that gets you right back to Justice O'Neill's question. That's a generic request for an instruction without applying it to a disputed fact issue, and the jury could find themselves in the same position that the Mitchell case found them, confused and making the plaintiff have a higher burden prove causation than FELA contemplates.
I guess in response to your question or your comment, there feasibly could be that confusion. The other option is to not instruct the jury at all on a necessary element
of
FELA contents.
Well, but I think what we're trying to find out here is why is it error in this case that you didn't get your instruction, and what does it take, or did it take at the time, to preserve that error based on your theory of your defense?
Your Honor, my position would be, it's obviously it's in the brief, it's that to preserve the error, we needed to present the issue of instructing the jury regarding foreseeability at a time prior to the case was
but
given to the jury.
But you do agree that your position is that foreseeability in this case, in your view, was a disputed fact question.
I agree.
So
that's
that
why I believe
even
the jury
under Mitchell, the court acknowledged that if that's the circumstance, then a question should be submitted to the jury to answer and resolve the dispute.
With all due respect to the court in Mitchell, the court did say that. If you read through the Mitchell opinion, we're in large agreement with the Mitchell opinion up to a point. It says that there was a disputed issue. There should be an instruction regarding foreseeability presented to this jury. But since it might get confusing, we're going to suggest you use this pattern jury charge that didn't include instruction regarding foreseeability.
Well, because it was only talking about causation. And you just indicated that you agreed with the previous question that foreseeability is not a factor in the causation issue in the Fela case. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Here's what Mitchell said. It says, we hold that the question of an employer's knowledge may be one for the jury. And they've just been talking about duty for 5 or 6 minutes. However, in this case, the instruction confused the issue of foreseeability relating to duty with the concept of causation. Now, doesn't that suggest, as Justice Stegman was saying, that if foreseeability is hotly contested, that it ought to be a separate question and not an instruction that can be related back to a particular question, because the question of duty is one of law and not of fact?
Well, Your Honor, my position that would be is that we preserve the error by offering this proposed jury instruction.
But is it worth it enough to just offer the instruction under your view of the factual disputes in the case?
Under my view, yes, it's enough.
So somehow the jury is not going to answer this question of the disputed fact question, was it foreseeable that this incident would happen? If, would you then say it would be the trial court's prerogative to resolve that dispute, and that's what it did here when they submitted the case and refused your instruction?
No, I don't believe it would be the trial court's prerogative to decide that dispute, because the FELA, the substantive law, says foreseeability is an element of the offense. And in retrospect,
as far as duty is concerned.
As far as duty is concerned, yes, sir.
Well, so your position then that in a FELA case, the jury should be asked a duty question?
Not in every single FELA case.
If there is a disputed fact, a disputed evidence on foreseeability as it relates to duty, then should the jury be asked whether or not the employer owed a duty to the employee as a question and part of its burden, the plaintiff's burden of proof?
If there's a disputed fact as that issue, yes.
Yes, sir. Should the jury be asked that question?
And to answer your question, yes, it should be asked that question.
And part of their next question, did you ask for the question in this case?
We asked for this particular jury instruction.
No, you asked for a question.
No, we didn't ask for a question.
How is foreseeability as it relates to duty, a determination of foreseeability as it relates to duty, different from the fact finder's determination of foreseeability as it relates to causation?
I think that represents some of the, not necessarily confusion, but the arguments back and forth in this brief is that the FELA says that a railroad employer is responsible for, is liable for its negligence, one part, that contributes to the injury, that it contributes in whole or in part to the injury of one of its employees. Whole or in part, that applies to the causation element. It's sometimes confused with the negligence part. Negligence in whole or in part. Negligence is its own standard. Did it contribute to whole or in part?
I guess my question is, let's assume that foreseeability is an issue, even in an FELA case as to causation. Is there a way you could describe to us how a jury could find it is not foreseeable with respect to causation, but is foreseeable with respect to duty? I mean, once the jury makes that determination, does it apply to both duty and causation? And if not, why not?
No, I don't think it does. And I think one of the cases that both sides have cited, but didn't really, that I read, and mind you, I'm the second attorney to come in and effectively brief the case, is the Gaelic case. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Maybe Gaelic versus Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, in which in that case there was an instruction regarding foreseeability as to duty. The jury found for the plaintiff in that case. The railroad, on intermediate appeal, won a reversal on the basis that in that case the situation had been that this employee he suffered some insect bites from what was described as a tepid pool of decaying animals and what have you, that attracted a lot of insects, and he suffered some insect bites and had some serious complications from that. The reason I tell you about the facts is that the railroad said that we were entitled, the plaintiff had a duty to show that we should have reasonably foreseen that this particular type of injury, this particular, you know, he didn't relate this specific insect, this particular type of injury, the plaintiff had a duty to show that we could reasonably foresee that. On ultimate appeal, the court said, no, you were entitled to your instruction regarding whether or not there was foreseeability of the duty, but not as that would be foreseeability of the regarding cause. And ultimately the case was reversed, but by in favor of the plaintiff. But I pointed out because in that case, the railroad was given the same exact jury instruction, a very similar, substantially similar jury instruction.
Let me ask you a question here. Respondent points out that in many of the states you rely on, the duty is a jury question. It's a question for the finder of fact, which it's not in Texas. Doesn't that make some of this law suspect?
No, I don't believe it does, Your Honor. In many states, yes, there is a duty can be a question for a jury. And taking this out of the FBLA situation, it would be a case such as this honorable court decided in Bowles v. Kerr, as cited in the case, that there's not a duty regarding negligent infliction of emotional distress. In this situation, what is substantive law regarding the FBLA is a federal standard. It needs to be uniform across different states. I don't see a conflict between that situation.
But there's, let's take this out of the abstract.
Okay.
The question, the jury would never be asked, did the railroad have a duty to its employee? What the jury would get asked is, was there a condition that injured the employee that was known or should have been known to the employer? That's the fact question, isn't it? Because it's the fact upon which the duty is based. So the question in this case to the jury would have been, was there a condition at this derailment that the railroad knew or should have known about that caused this injury? That's where the duty would come from. Was there a condition that they knew or should have known about and they failed to repair? Now, the railroad has a policy that, I guess, based on derailments, you're supposed to stand back, I don't know, 15 feet or something. I mean, so they were...
Depends on what type of activity is going on, but yes. Standard.
Is your argument... The argument seems to me, if you preserved error, is that the plaintiff failed to get a finding that supports the judgment. They failed to get a finding of a disputed fact, which is this knew or should have known about a condition the railroad failed to repair. Isn't that...
Yes,
that's
sir.
Your point. They failed to ask this question. And you say you preserved the error by submitting a general instruction on foreseeability, and therefore you're entitled to argue that we're missing a finding on an element. And that's where we're going.
Yes,
so
sir.
My question for you, what is it that was disputed in the facts about what the railroad knew or didn't know? Was it they did not know that in the case of a derailment, a pipe cap, some piece of equipment, as they're moving this heavy stuff, some piece of equipment might break free and be thrown a certain distance and injure an employee? Are you saying they didn't know that would happen? Or are you saying that what they didn't know is that this piece of equipment could be thrown as far as it was thrown?
If I had to choose between the two that you're saying, it's the latter, that we didn't know it could be thrown as far as it's thrown. You know, any time you...
And so you're thinking that what the jury should have been asked is, we know that equipment can be thrown as a result of derailment, But because this got thrown 50 feet instead of 25 feet, we're entitled to a question before the jury about whether or not that was not foreseeable. That's what we were asking for, yes, Judge.
Because you're going to have, everyone's going to agree in a FELA case that the railroad work is inherently dangerous. Okay. We had knowledge that things, that cables snap, things happen in a re-railing or after a cleanup, after a derailment situation. Here,
in fact, you have has a rule on where people are supposed to stand because they foresee that pieces of equipment will go flying around.
Exactly, and they have to stand even further back if they're dealing with hazardous materials. And the testimony of trial showed that we were in compliance with those rules, and the testimony that we were trying to elicit until Judge Parsons excluded it sua sponte after overruling Mr. Berry's objection was that following those rules in derailment situations, no one had ever seen an accident that happened like this. We didn't come up with the word freak accident. It was used by the witnesses themselves and not their coaching.
That gets me to your other issue about the mid-trial sua sponte statement by the trial judge. Your briefing to me indicates that you say that you base your theory on why it's preserved on looking and interpreting Trap Rule 33.1 or Rule of Evidence 103. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
What exactly did you say in your motion for new trial would have been your objection to that statement by the court if you'd made it then? That it was a misstatement of the law and that you wanted it corrected, or that that was improper because you're entitled to have, was it an evidentiary complaint or a misstatement of the law complaint?
A misstatement of the law.
So is it a fair statement to say that Rule 103 just applies in cases where you're complaining about either admitting or excluding evidence, and that's not the nature of your objection to what the trial court said in this case?
Well, Your Honor, the nature of my objection would be that the judge also did instruct the jury to disregard the testimony from Mr. I hope I pronounced his name correctly, Mr. Peacock.
But I still need to know what your objection is because I'm trying to figure
my
out.
My objection is that it's both a misstatement.
Only 33.1 that applies and not the evidentiary rule because of the nature of your objection.
I believe they both apply because it was a misstatement of the law and the judge instructed the jury to.
Did you say that in your motion for new trial?
I can't, Liam, and not certain.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
The
court is ready for argument from Ms.
Brown. May it please the court, Mr. Furlow, argument for the respondent.
Your honors, may it please the court. My name is David Furlow, and together with trial counsel Mark Berry, I represent Seymour Williams in the above case. I had originally intended to come here and focus strongly on the multiple and repeated waivers of the matters first alleged, first briefed, and first made the subject of a discussion of the case law in the Court of Appeals, and to argue that a judge who comports with the controlling case law of the Texas Supreme Court and issues jury instructions that are in accordance with those of the conservative Fifth Circuit does not abuse his discretion in the FELA case. But
which means we could never reverse a jury charged case in terms of the law because it wouldn't be an abuse of discretion.
Well, Your Honor, in a situation where it is federal procedural, where it is federal substantive law, and there has not been a United States Supreme Court decision since the time of the original consideration, and where the jury instruction comports with that of the admittedly conservative Fifth Circuit, I would submit that whatever might be the case with respect to stare decisis, it's not a change in the law is not warranted here. And my arguments would be that there was no abuse of discretion here, and that there has been no change in the law as enunciated by the United States Supreme Court that would warrant a reconsideration of this opinion, especially of the Mitchell decision, especially given the facts that are present here. But the one thing that I...
Hadn't the Supreme Court said that the whole concept of negligence under the FELA is a federal question? It's resolved by federal law, not state law?
Actually, Your Honor, on substantive issues, that is correct. But with respect to procedural law, when we said in Mitchell,
that in Texas the existence of a duty is a question of law, we should not have been applying Texas law. We should have been applying federal law.
No, Your Honor, that is not correct. And the reason it is not correct is because this court in Mitchell and in the Dutton case and the other Texas Supreme Court cases cited recognized, as the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized in the St. Louis Southwestern Railway Company case as cited in our brief on the merits, that procedural issues of what matters are submitted
what
to a jury.
What is a duty? I'm just going to the fact, what is a duty under, is it, that's not a procedural issue, is it?
The issue of whether the jury gets a part.
I'm not talking about the jury. I'm focusing on the language in Mitchell that says, in Texas, the existence of a duty is a question of law.
I agree with that.
That's not procedural, is it? That's substantive.
That's substantive.
And that was a mistaken statement. It should have been decided under federal substantive law. What is a duty under the FELA?
Well, Your Honor, with respect to determination of duty, traditionally, of course, that has been done in Texas, as opposed to other states, by the judge.
I'm asking, but this is federal law, so federal law should govern what the duty is under an FELA case. Isn't that what the U.S. Supreme Court has said?
Federal law governs the substantive requirements, but the way the Mitchell Court recognized that conceivably foreseeability issues could be determined, submitted to the jury in the right
case.
I'm
asking about substantive law.
Substantive law, the law owed by the railroad to the employee, should be decided by judges as duty law. And that should be, that should indeed be federal law, substantive law.
Well, is it fair to say that as a matter of federal substantive law, foreseeability is an element, and whether that's decided by the judge or jury is a procedural issue for the states to decide?
Basically, Your Honor, except that the Gallick decision is cited by opposing counsel, where this matter was actually discussed in some depth, there the U.S. Supreme Court did not use the word element, but ingredient.
Okay.
And in fact, ingredient is consistent with the way this court and you, Justice Hecht, in a number of decisions have said that foreseeability is a factor or one aspect of the duty analysis. Mellon Mortgage versus Holder, Timberwalk Partners.
But I guess my point is that's the piece that would constitute the federal substantive law, whether you call it an ingredient or an element, and that how to determine that is a matter of state procedural law, whether the judge or the jury decides the foreseeability piece.
Yes, Your Honor. That is correct, and that is our position. And that's the way there's a fuzzy line between procedural law and substantive
law. Okay, so what would be wrong with it? We've got some language in Mitchell that says if the foreseeability piece of duty is factually intensive and there's a fact issue on foreseeability, that should be submitted to the jury.
Well, that is within a court's discretion, a trial judge's discretion to submit to the jury. Yes, Your Honor. So it could occur under those circumstances. And so,
well, let me ask you this then, when you say in the discretion to submit or not submit, isn't the trial court supposed to submit disputed fact questions to the fact finder, which would be a jury in that kind of case?
Well, other courts dealing with these same issues, and specifically the Missouri cases that I've cited as are attached to our brief on the merits, as appendices 9, 10, 11, in situations where a representative or supervisor of the railroad company has given testimony that reflects the railroad's actual notice of the condition of the problem there, then under those circumstances, it does not go to the jury. The judge determines as a matter of law that the duty is owed.
Well, I understand that, but assume, and just take the facts in this case, they dispute whether this was foreseeable or not. And we say under our law that it's the court's prerogative to determine the duty issue. But we also say in Mitchell, if foreseeability is disputed, then it should be submitted to the jury. If you go the other way and say it's purely a question of law, then the trial court's beginning to make credibility and factual determinations when there's two opposing views. How can we have that?
Here, Your Honor, under these facts, what the railroad was doing was saying we didn't...
I understand what they do, but I'm a little concerned about the mechanics of what you suggest. That well, the trial court always decides duty as a matter of law, and even if there's a dispute, well, maybe the jury should get it, but he could still decide it's a matter. Only way you can decide it's a matter of law if there's no other evidence other than they knew everything that was going on, and in particular here, this case, if this cap would go 70 feet.
Well, Your Honor, specifically here, what we had is Wilfred Forbes, the union supervisor there, a representative of the company, who was admitting that he had knowledge of these flying braking rails and other things, and other officers of the company saying that they had knowledge of snapping cables and other dangers, indicating that the railroad was amply and actually aware of the dangers of flying objects, torsion propelled, at derailment sites.
But surely now, it's an issue whether they go 10 feet or 10 miles. I mean, surely it's an issue how far they go. Just because you know that a cable snaps doesn't mean that you know that somebody a long way away is going to get hurt by it.
The issue of that, Your Honor, here what we have is actually on this record, Wilfred Forbes saying that he had warned the people to clear away the folks before the re-railing operations occurred. It did not occur. That shows that the railroad, through its supervisors, had actual knowledge, not constructive knowledge, but actual knowledge of the danger presented.
Wasn't that with respect to hazardous objects? Didn't I read in the briefs that warning that you just mentioned was with respect to hazardous materials in one of the cars?
They present that as the hazmat issue, but his testimony, Wilfred Forbes' testimony, was not specifically related to that. And the issue, as it comes back to Justice Baker, is one of the railroad companies saying this particular freak accident and this cap flying this distance and hitting this man in this particular place was not foreseeable. But that's completely an erroneous legal analysis under the U.S. Supreme Court's Gallick decision, under this court's decisions, that if the general danger is appreciated, the plaintiff does not have to prove the foreseeability of the specific series of sequence of
consequences. So then is your argument, in this case, their view of their defense of unforeseeability in the duty aspect as a legal theory doesn't stand up, so the trial court's really just making a legal decision when he says, no, it just has to be a general appreciation. They don't have to know that this cap's going to come off at that time and go 70 feet and hit a worker. Is that your view then?
That is our view, buttressed by the fact that their failure to present a complete record precludes this court from engaging in the sort of entire record harmless error analysis or abuse of discretion analysis that would be essential to any reversal of a case where the predicated harm is under an abuse of discretion standard for charge, error, or judicial comments. They had the opportunity and expressly declined the opportunity to request the opening statements and the closing arguments, and therefore waived any right to show that there was indeed a harmless error analysis. But if the court will just grant me the indulgence of presenting to the court the actual case dispositive case law that I regret to inform you I was only advised of and became aware of over the past day. And this is the case, this is the case law which I submit will convince this court that Union Pacific failed to submit a substantially correct charge request as required by Rule 297, that they submitted a charge that was defective and incurably defective as enunciated by this Supreme Court in three decisions, the Texas Commission of Appeals in one decision, and two courts of civil appeals. This is not in the briefing.
What case?
Specifically, Your Honor, that is three cases are J.H. Blaines versus Allman, Lewis, and Company, 71 Tex 529, 537, 9 Southwest 543, at pages 545, 546. That's an 1888 Texas Supreme Court decision. The other two cases are Missouri Pacific Railway Company versus Bartlett, 81 Tex 42 at 44, 16 Southwest 638, 1891 decision, and Blunzer versus DeWeese and Hinkle, 79 Tex 272 at 275, 15 Southwest 2929, 1891. And the Commission of Appeals is Peden Iron and Steel Company versus James, 208 Southwest 898. And specifically here, this goes to their request. Their request, if you look at it, is appendices to our Williams brief on the merits, the last big brief we gave you. If you look at it, you will find that it is Appendix 4. There, the peculiar language of it is that results from the Union Pacific's attempt to weigh the evidence and to impose a higher standard than the preponderance of evidence standard that is applicable in all civil cases here. And this is why their request was fatally defective from the outset, and why this is not the proper vehicle that you might want to utilize in order to reconsider the Mitchell case. Specifically, what Union Pacific said is, to find that a railroad had notice, actual or constructive, of a defective condition, you must be satisfied that such notice was received by an employee who is authorized to repair or remedy. Then it comes down and he uses that language, you must be satisfied, a second time in that same proposed request. That language is fatally defective under controlling Texas Supreme Court decisions that have never been reversed or reconsidered. In the 19th century, in the 1880s, people were submitting these you must be satisfied charges. It came up to the Texas Supreme Court, and in the Blaines versus Ullman, Lewis and Company decision, that's Southwest, that's 9 Southwest 543, 545, 546. This court ruled, and I quote, there is another part of the charge complained of that is erroneous, in that it required the jury to be satisfied, italics in the original Supreme Court decision, that the appellant sold the goods to his former wife, which were claimed to have been fraudulently conveyed. It is not necessary that the evidence should have been sufficient to satisfy, italics in the original, the jury of the facts, in order to entitle appellant to a verdict. For he would have been entitled to this upon a consideration of all the evidence the jury had been of the opinion, if the jury had been of the opinion that the facts necessary to recovery by him were established by a preponderance of the evidence. And the court said, evidence is said to satisfy the mind when it is such as frees the mind from doubt, suspense, or uncertainty. The jury may have believed that the evidence preponderated in favor of the existence of the facts, yet under the charge, the jury would have felt bound to render a verdict against him if their minds were not freed from doubt and uncertainty. On account of the errors noticed, the judgment will be reversed and the cause remanded. Then, 2 years later, in the Missouri Pacific case, another railway case similar to this one, this court added and quoted on page 44, that would be 81 text 42, at page 44, this court stated, quote, in Greenleaf on evidence, it is said, by satisfactory evidence, which is sometimes called sufficient evidence, is intended that amount of proof which ordinarily satisfies an unprejudiced mind beyond a reasonable doubt. And so the judgment was reversed and remanded because the jury instruction in that case said, and if the proof satisfies you, and if such facts are established by the evidence to your satisfaction, the same erroneous language that UP stuck into its charge to raise the standard not only above the ordinary Texas common law standard, but way above the relaxed liberal construction Teddy Roosevelt 1908 FELA law, which has substantially relaxed causation and foreseeability standards. And so
what do you make of the instruction in the charge, a yes answer must be based on a preponderance of the evidence?
Well, what I make is that a jury is going to be confused, and that's what this court and other courts of appeal have ruled in similar situations, because specifically, let's actually talk about one case, Walker versus Dawley, 4 Southwest 2nd, 159 at 161, Texas Civil Appeals Court, 1928, writ of error dismissed. That's where this, where the court, summarizing not only the three cases from the Supreme Court I've given you, but others, said, and I quote, we have reached the conclusion that the trial court erred in the instruction given to the effect that the burden was upon plaintiff to prove the fraud alleged to the satisfaction of the jury. Nor do we believe that the error was cured by the language used in other portions of the same instruction, which placed the burden of proof upon plaintiff to make out his case by a preponderance of the evidence. Going back to the Ullman case, where there's preponderance and the satisfaction standard. They're confusing, they're different standards, satisfaction is higher, and that means that the request that UP submitted was erroneous as a matter of law and would require this court to find that it was acceptable, to find that it accurately stated the law, would be to chuck out a number of well-established 110-year-old decisions that no one has second-guessed in over a second.
And
they
have not been cited to us until now. But let me ask you...
For that, I apologize, Your Honor.
Yes. Let me ask you, though, so I'll be clear on the legal position.
Yes, Your Honor.
If the instruction did not have that problem in it, and there were a conflict in the evidence about the foreseeability of this accident, should an instruction be given to the jury, in your view?
No, Your Honor, and I'm relying upon Bill Powers and his seminal article about the judge and jury in Texas law, where he points out the very good policy reasons that juries and jurors should not be making the policy that goes into duty determination.
Well, I understand that, and the policy is you ought not to have to exercise care if you don't know something bad's going to happen. But if there's a dispute about that, I mean, if there really is a who shot John, two people saying, yes, we knew, no, we didn't know, you don't submit that to the jury.
It is conceivable that it could be, but it would not occur in this particular case, and this is another reason this is not an appropriate vehicle for reconsidering Mitchell because of the omissions of the supervisor.
I'm asking if there were that case. I know that's your position here, but if there were that kind of dispute, does it go to the jury or is it resolved by the judge?
I would submit that determination of whether it is sufficient to go to a jury, whether it is sufficient to create a duty, is one that we accord to the discretion of the trial court judge, consistent with the Mitchell majority. And I understand that you might have, you know, differences with that, but I would submit that that issue should be properly raised and analyzed in a situation where somebody such as CUP actually presents the entire record with the opening statements, the closing arguments, and articulates their position to the trial court judge.
I'm trying to get at an answer to a legal question. It's an abstract legal question, and that is, in a FELA case where you have a dispute over foreseeability, does the issue go to the jury or not? And that's all I'm trying to get from you. Not this case, not UP, not this issue, in the abstract, does it go or not?
In the abstract, in my opinion, Your Honor, no. Okay. I trust the judges to make the duty determination and the foreseeability determination, but I could understand how reasonable minds could differ.
But why should it be different that foreseeability as an element of causation go to the jury if facts are disputed on foreseeability? But that same question, again, as factually intensive, wouldn't go to a jury under the duty element.
And, Your Honor, it is because I could conceive of a situation where someone could, upon serious deliberation, craft an instruction that might analyze or submit to the jury a question of what is foreseeable with respect to what duties the railroad might owe to the particular party, and not tread upon the causation issue. I think it would be extremely hard. I've struggled with it, and I haven't been able to come up with one. And I would submit that if you actually look at the Gallick decision that everybody's talking about, the Supreme Court decision, if you go back to that, you'll see that there's some two dozen interrogatories given to the jury there because there is no general submission statute there. Broad form practice there in Ohio at the time, and there the jury actually came back and said no to the two questions, 22 and 24, that asked them to make a determination of foreseeability. And the Supreme Court reconciled those with the other answers and evidence there and concluded that, well, despite what the jury said, it was still a foreseeable injury that this person, Gallick, would suffer a bite by an insect, and that should have been foreseen by the insurance, by the railroad under the reduced standards of negligence and causation and FELA.
Mr. Furlow, I would like to follow up on something you mentioned earlier. Is it your position that the evidence is not disputed on foreseeability as an element of duty within the appropriate legal definition? That is more of a general version of foreseeability as opposed to the specific, could this incident have ever happened before? Is it your view that the evidence is undisputed under the appropriate legal standard, or is it disputed under the appropriate legal standard?
It is my position that under the appropriate legal standard of awareness of the general danger, the admissions of
not only Wilfred Forbes, but also Pico and other fellows quoted in pages 2 through 10 of our brief on the merits, established that they were aware of the general danger, and through them, as supervisors, Union Pacific Railroad, and that specifically, the court goes off on the wrong analysis when it accepts their freak accident argument that this particular cap being popped off and flying this particular distance, a point which is disputed, whether it's 20 feet or 50 feet,
That's the wrong analysis. So your view is the evidence on foreseeability under the applicable legal standard is undisputed in this case.
That is my position, Your Honor.
Well, but if there's a dispute as to how far it flew, how could it be undisputed?
Well,
I mean, if one person, however credible, says it only flew 20 feet, and one person says 70, isn't that some sort of jury determination that would affect the range of safety that the workers were required to stand back from?
Your Honor, I just present accurately the disputed, the statements about how far this thing flew, whether that in fact was foreseeable, whether that constituted negligence. The jury answered in the affirmative, and I would submit in the absence of properly specific and timely objections to this trial court judge pointing out the errors that were first briefed on appeal, and more importantly, in the absence of the opening and closing statements.
I understand all the other arguments, but there is a disputed fact issue as to how far this flew that could define the foreseeability piece of duty.
That is correct. There is differences of opinion expressed in the testimony. And all I would submit there is that under this court's opinion, flying this particular distance, a point which is disputed, whether it's 20 feet or 50 feet,
So your view is the evidence on foreseeability under the applicable legal standard is undisputed in this case.
That is my position, Your Honor.
Well, but if there's a dispute as to how far it flew, how could it be undisputed?
Well,
I mean, if one person, however credible, says it only flew 20 feet, and one person says 70, isn't that some sort of jury determination that would affect the range of safety that the workers were required to stand back from?
Your Honor, I just present accurately the disputed, the statements about how far this thing flew, whether that in fact was foreseeable, whether that constituted negligence. The jury answered in the affirmative, and I would submit in the absence of properly specific and timely objections to this trial court judge pointing out the errors that were first briefed on appeal, and more importantly, in the absence of the opening and closing statements.
I understand all the other arguments, but there is a disputed fact issue as to how far this flew that could define the foreseeability piece of duty.
That is correct. There is differences of opinion expressed in the testimony. And all I would submit there is that under this court's applicable standards of error preservation and complete record review, all of those inferences must be found in support of the judgment as it stands because they didn't present you the adequate record to review the issue. For those reasons, Your Honor.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Reserve the remainder of my time. I thought there might be some questions at that point in time, but the questions came rather early in the argument. So let me respond to a few things Mr. Furlow said. Namely, this argument that we didn't preserve error because we didn't present the opening statement and the closing arguments. This is a question as to...
Well, let me, before you get to that, if what he has said is correct, that this statement in the proper instruction is wrong as a matter of law because it incorporates an improper proof standard of satisfaction, then don't we have an insurmountable preservation point here? In other words, that would be a defective instruction. That would not be enough to preserve error on your...
Your Honor, not having had a chance to review those cases, I'm not going to take a position of whether or not I believe it is defective. Have a chance to take a look at those cases, but I don't believe that the standard is the Union Pacific would have to present a substantially correct jury instruction at a time before the case was presented to the jury to preserve its error. We don't believe this jury instruction as presented. We believe it was substantially correct.
Well, you just don't know that at this point.
I honestly don't know at this point. However, I do believe it's sufficient to preserve. The question is substantially correct. It's sufficient to preserve the error presented to the judge.
Would you be interested in answering those four cases with some law to support your viewpoint?
I would love to answer those four cases.
I think we'd appreciate a response.
I would appreciate the opportunity.
Did you write them all down like I did?
Excuse me?
I said he didn't bring his copies as far as I know, so I tried to write down the citations. Do you have them all?
I believe I got all the citations. I'm sure being officers of the court, I can probably call Mr. Furlow and he will make sure I get the right citations. Ultimately, as my time expires, I want to... our position is we preserve this error, that the jury needed to be instructed by law regarding the issue of foreseeability of the duty, and the court, what we can all agree on is that the court followed what it understood to be the law in Mitchell, as a trial court would do and an appellate court would do. It followed the instructions from the Supreme Court. The position is that, harking back to Justice Heck's dissent, I don't cite it just because he happens to be here on the bench, but because he made a comment in there that if you follow the ruling, as it was, his fear is that, I don't mean put words in his mouth, but his fear is that, as Mitchell could be applied, it gave you two options. Either you properly instructed a jury regarding foreseeability, a necessary element of the offense, pardon me, it's my former prosecutor coming out, necessary element of the case, of liability, or you didn't instruct the jury regarding a necessary element, and in effect, created absolute liability on the part of the railroad.
Which is exactly what happened in this case. Do you agree with Mr. Furlow's recitation of the Supreme Court's holding in Gaelic that the question, that what the elements may be is a question of substantive law under FELA and a question of federal law, but the question of whether a judge or jury decides a particular question in a FELA case, such as duty, is a question of state law?
No, I don't.
You don't think that Gaelic says that?
I don't believe Gaelic says that. I believe Gaelic says
that.
What
does Gaelic say on that issue, then? What would be your response to his argument that Gaelic says that?
My position regarding Gaelic would be, that a defendant's duties are measured by what's pardon me. Gaelic goes in great detail to explain what is required within a jury instruction and as to the prima facie case of a claim for negligence under the FELA. And I would use that language in Gaelic, and I can't give you a specific site right now.
But I understand that. But my understanding of federal law, and I'm not sure if I'm correct or not, and I wanted you to help clarify, is that with respect to substantive law in a FELA case, we look to federal law, and with respect to procedural issues, state law controls. And that, in fact, the question of whether a judge or jury should decide a particular issue in a FELA case is a procedural issue that is to be determined by the applicable state law. Is that a correct recitation of what the federal courts have said in FELA cases, or am I mistaken?
I don't believe that's an accurate recitation.
Okay. In what way is it? What are the state law? What matters in a FELA case would be decided under state law?
And I may be mistaken in my understanding, but those substantive issues are to be standing as regarding the elements of the claim under the FELA are to be presented to the jury.
And you think that's a matter of federal law, or is that a matter of state law?
Perhaps I'm confusing it.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Chancellor. That concludes the argument of the second clause, and we'll take another brief recess.